So Jane Flaherty joined the faculty here at Pitt in October 2010. She completed her doctoral work at the Harvard School of Public Health in 2006 and has held a joint postdoc position with Harvard and the Yale School of Medicine. And so prior to being here, it's probably a joke there for the Ivy League people, but I'm not. prior to joining us here at Pitt in the Graduate School of Public Health faculty, she was the senior air quality scientist at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, where she managed a study on year-round intra-urban variation in multiple pollutants throughout New York City communities. And her work focuses on the interface between chronic stressors and air pollution exposure in both community and occupational settings. So, glad you're here today, Jane. And Jesse Carr is also here. She came here right about when Jane did, from New York City. In 2011, to manage a study of social stressors and susceptibility to air pollution in childhood asthma. She completed her Master's of Public Health in Columbia, and she's currently a doctoral candidate here at Pitt in the Graduate School of Public Health. She's interested in mixed methods and GIS-based approaches for understanding social and physical contributors to health disparities. And last but not least, we have Isaac Johnson, who's a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh in Environmental Studies. He graduated last April. He's now returned part-time to pursue his Master's of Information Science and Geoinformatics. We'll be talking to you later. and he actually, and I didn't know they had this until I saw the bio, but he actually heads the GIS program at Bettis Atomic Power Labs in West Mifflin. And much like Kristen Kerlin, and many of us in the room, he loves maps. Did you write this? Okay. Well, I just wanted to say thanks. And one of the things that this project really illustrates as we get through the presentation, the great collaborations we have not only here within the university, but we have across cities. So here at the University Center for Social and Urban Research, we have a survey research program that has been involved along with the Urban and Regional Analysis Program in this project, in terms of helping with the survey work and everything else that they'll talk about. And one of the other partners that we brought into the project from our National Neighborhood Indicators Partnership, the Providence Plan, also had an instrumental role in helping with the technology. So it's a really neat project. You're going to love it. We'll go through with the lecture. We'll have time at the end for questions. I will be in the back of the room if anyone needs anything. To plug our brown bag series, you have flyers here in the room in front of you, hopefully, if we did things right. Our next speaker actually has a topic much related to this one in some of her research, Claudia Colton. So we're pleased that she'll be joining us. We also have a very busy February calendar. Any of these you want to come to, please let me know. They will be held here in the room, and we hope to see you there. They're going to be fantastic speakers. So with that, after I pass out the sign-in sheet, take it away. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Bob. Okay, hello and good morning, everyone, or good early afternoon. My name is Jane Flaherty. Thank you, Bob, for the wonderful introduction. We're very, very happy to be here today and to present some of the work that we've been doing with colleagues here at UXER and with other partners as well. We're really appreciative that all of you ventured out in the cold to be here. Let's see, do I have a pointer to work with?
It should be going up there.
Is this one?
Is that it?
Well, maybe I'll just do this the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, but what's that? Rob always has something for that one.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll work without one today. Okay. So as Bob mentioned, we're going to be presenting some work that we've done on developing a GIS-based tool for eliciting neighborhood information from large numbers of individuals, say, participating in an epidemiological study or a health research study. Much of our work does focus on the health of urban communities, trying to understand the combined effects of both social stress-related exposures and physical environmental exposures, such as air pollution. So a tool like this to help us better understand neighborhoods is extraordinarily valuable. And we are very appreciative for all of the work that's been performed here at UXER to help us sort of develop methods to better address these questions. So to get us started, we have an overall goal in understanding the combined effects of air pollution and other physical exposures and chronic stressors on health. And here's why. A quick snapshot across New York City will show you that fine particulate, airborne fine particle exposures, poverty rates, and asthma rates are very differently distributed across the city. That's probably no surprise to anybody here. There's no question that we have health disparities that vary within urban areas, environmental exposures that vary within urban areas, and social stressors, such as poverty, that vary within urban areas. The question we ask is, how do the physical exposures and the social exposures combine to help us understand better how they might be affecting health outcomes that vary across urban communities, and how might we potentially understand how to intervene towards improving urban health and reducing health disparities? If you stare at these maps long enough, there's a couple things that you'll understand or that might jump out to you. Again, number one, they do vary quite a bit. Rates vary across the urban area. Number two, these are very different maps. Okay, so it's not the case that air pollution, for example, directly layers onto asthma emergency department visits for children. There's some other intervening variables that are very much important on that pathway. And the third thing that I notice, at least to my eye, is that the asthma map looks a little bit more like the poverty map to me than does the air pollution map. And the overlay between the two may be the most important of all. So we're developing methods towards tearing this all apart. Jesse and I, while working a couple of years ago at Department of Health in New York City, sort of developed a set of ideas and framework hypotheses which have become the underlying basis for the larger EPA STAR grant that we're working on now. And what we think about is the patterning of urban pollution sources across an urban area, how those affect concentrations of pollutants across an urban area, and how those ultimately might impact on a wide number of different health outcomes. As I mentioned, we often work with asthma. We're also very interested in the role of psychosocial stress on childhood asthma. There is now a large amount of literature showing us that both child and parental stress, through physiologic alterations associated with chronic stress, may impact both the exacerbation and the original etiology of asthma. We also are now understanding, through work performed by our colleague Bruce McEwen at Rockefeller University, that there are impacts of psychosocial stressors on a number of important regulatory systems in the body, including immune function, endocrine function, metabolic function. These are collectively referred to as allostatic load mechanisms, and they generally help us understand how chronic stress, prevalent in many urban communities, may make the body more susceptible overall to other physical exposures which it may encounter, including pollution or allergens or a wide number of other exposures. So there's an interaction or an interplay between these, which is increasingly important that we understand. So here's the larger EPA STAR grant that we're working under now. We activate this framework, and we dive in through three large goals. First of all, in order to examine the combined effects of social stressors and air pollution on childhood asthma patterns, we're leveraging pollution maps from the New York City Community Air Survey, which we previously worked on in New York, and I'll show you a couple of those maps in a moment. We then dove in, or really Jesse dove in, to identify and validate every possible indicator she could find in publicly available GIS data to help us understand variation in chronic stressors throughout the urban area. And third, of course, we dive in through refined multi-level epidemiologic methods to understand how these may interact. Okay, so that's the larger frame we're working under. So, for the air pollution, step one, we drew our surfaces from New York City Community Air Survey, which is the original study that this all sort of sprang out of. This is the study I was managing while working at Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, and I want you to notice a few things here. After diving in and measuring air pollution year-round at 155 sites for every possible pollutant we could think of, we were able to get down to some pretty fine-scale surfaces. So notice that air pollution does not observe geographic boundaries. The community district outlines in New York are not necessarily where the gradients occur in air pollution. Okay? I also want you to notice that these are three very different maps. So fine particulate air pollution does not necessarily look like nitrogen dioxide air pollution, definitely does not look like ozone, a secondary pollutant which is scavenged by fresh nitrogen dioxide in places of its highest concentration. So notice that air pollution varies tremendously across urban communities, and that pattern is very different depending upon which pollutant you're working with, which made it so important that we had done this fine-scale modeling already in air pollution. Then, the question that Jesse and I really bounced off of in taking it from here, the next step is, what would happen if we tried to understand susceptibility in as fine spatial detail as we now understand air pollution. So that's where we're going. Yes?
Jane, is that survey still going on?
Yes, it is.
It's in about its fourth year now.
That's correct. So it's been scaled down, so it's no longer 155 sites. It's down to about 100. So we set out this large goal for ourselves of trying to measure chronic stress in a refined way across an urban area. And we recognize that there's one really important difference about stressors, which makes them different from pollution exposures. Stress is all about perception. Okay? The same thing that's stressful to one person is not stressful to another. My favorite example is divorce. Some people will tell you that divorce is absolutely the worst thing that they've ever lived through in their entire life. Other people will tell you it's the greatest. Okay? Stressors are not uniformly distributed across individuals. They're not uniformly perceived. Okay? But when you work with certain stressors, such as violence rates, you're pretty sure that people are going to see that as a negative thing. Okay? So, again, we dove in on collecting publicly available data on aggregate stressors at the community level. We then dove in and have just completed a large series of focus groups across New York City to help us understand, by talking with residents in various communities, what are the most important stressors in your community. And some communities did talk about violence, and other communities wanted to talk about the commute. Okay? And then we dove in at an individual level, and UXR has been really fundamentally critical in helping us to enable phone surveys and online surveys throughout New York City to ask people, where do you live and are you stressed? And for the first time, unbelievable that this hasn't been done before, we actually dove in to systematically validate across one urban area whether or not community-level chronic stressors resonated at the individual level to really explain geographic variability and susceptibility. This is the enormous suite of stressors that Jesse's been working with in GIS from across New York. We capture a lot of different constructs: crime and violence, factors in the physical and built environment, noise disruption, etc. Notice that there's a difference between what you think you're capturing, say violence, and the imperfect indicators that are out there available to us. Many of us who work in GIS are very familiar with this idea. We usually don't have the indicator that we want. Okay? Secondly, notice that these are all collected at very different spatial scales, because each of the agencies that we collected data from operates to their own purposes in their own spatial scales. Police precincts are structured by the police department for their purposes. They don't match up with a zip code or a community district or a school district, which are geographic areas slated for different purposes and therefore data that's pre-aggregated to different spatial scales, which of course creates an enormous problem for us when we're working in GIS trying to combine data across a lot of different domains. So that's the problem we're going to be diving into today, this problem of spatial scales and how to verify spatial scales within an area. Okay, I'm going to show you a quick series of maps for, again, the different types of indicators that Jesse and Isaac have been working in across New York. Quick snapshot, this is what felony rates look like across New York, collected by police precincts. Watch this map. Serious housing violations, child abuse and neglect, prevalence of going without needed medical care, noise disruption, households below 200% of the poverty level. Okay, notice anything? Let's go backwards. Did the maps look the same?
Similar.
To some extent. There are definitely some neighborhoods that light up in both maps. Okay? For those of you familiar with New York, the quick overview: Manhattan, the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island. You'll see that northern Manhattan, the Bronx, does light up in quite a few of these maps, okay? Which makes sense. Traditional EJ neighborhood of concern, and our partners WEACT have been very active in environmental justice work there for decades. There are a few other neighborhoods, such as central Brooklyn, which light up in both maps. But if you sort of step back and look at the view of the city as a whole, you'll notice that you get an overall pattern that's very different with each different indicator. And that's our concern. We recognize that using something like a poverty rate does not necessarily capture the spatial variation across the city and all of these other stressors that may be important. The other thing to notice, if you watch the boundaries, okay, this example is not too severe because these are all at United Health Fund or Community District area, and that one's at Police Precinct. But the boundaries do bounce around. When we bring in some of our other spatial areas, a zip code, census tract, etc., those boundaries start bouncing a lot. And that's our problem in combining data. So, to motivate the rest of what we'll talk about today, for the GIS indicators, we recognize that we need to validate the content, that is this stressor important in your community and to you, and we need to validate the scale at which we're using the geographic indicator. Many of us, I'm sure, are familiar with the modifiable aerial unit problem, the MOP. Effectively, the size and shape of how you aggregate your data matters, because where that boundary line is drawn can completely change the number that you get on average within a certain area. Okay? Some of you may be familiar with that concept through redistricting. Okay? So we're going to talk a lot about how to validate spatial scales and the technologies we've developed to help us do that. And we're going to ask questions about whether we can reconfigure data to the same spatial scale when we're stuck with these very different administrative areas. Jesse actually gives a separate very beautiful talk on this second point. We won't really go into it today, but do feel free to ask her if you're interested. And then finally, we're asking the underlying question of, is there an existing smooth surface in chronic stress in New York that we can derive through this understanding of both community level and individual level data so that we can ultimately understand fine patterning in stress or susceptibility in as much detail as we now understand air pollution. And it's been very generous funding from the Uxer Stephen Manners Award that will allow us to keep moving forward to explore that question. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to Jesse, who will get us started in the rest of the presentation. I lost a bottle of water.
Okay, thank you. Okay. All right, thank you, Dean. All right, so I'm just, for the rest of the talk, I'll start off with talking a little bit about neighborhood geography, specifically for in public health research. Isaac will take us through some of the nuts and bolts of how we sought to assess this, and then we'll talk about the validation study results and some future directions. So there's just been, I think we're probably all here, motivated by this explosion in neighborhood effects research over the past 20 years across a wide variety of domains. And importantly, you know, multi-level studies, really being able to disentangle the separate effects at the individual level and from neighborhood level exposures. So in public health research, and I'm sure in social and other urban fields, we generally use these administrative areas as imperfect proxies, as Jane so eloquently laid out. Knowing that we have this inherent mismatch between the scale at which data is available and the actual scale of the exposure or process of interest, as well as the fact, as Jane mentioned, that these are likely to vary across individuals, even neighbors, and across space. So creating the potential for a systematic bias in that in our health research due to that mismatch. So I'm going to talk about two studies that were motivating for this work. The first one was from Dr. Luke Basta at the University of Pennsylvania. And this was part of the space-time adolescent risk study, in which the overall goal is to understand how youth behaviors, like carrying weapons or consuming alcohol, and the places that they hang out, whether they're, you know, how much access to alcohol outlets, influence their likelihood of being assaulted. So this was a longitudinal case-control study, so as part of their rapport building with these young people, they had a mapping exercise where they were asked to draw their neighborhood area. So they did this, and then the investigators then took these hand-drawn maps, digitized them, doesn't quite say how they did that, and then compared them with administrative areas that would commonly be used to, you know, quantify, say, how many, the number of liquor stores in their residential census tract. So they were really trying to untie this. And here are some of their results from just 9 subjects. So not surprisingly, they saw wide variation in the size and shape of perceived neighborhood areas. And just in these 9 subjects, you see a range from 1 to 17 almost square kilometers, which is quite a big thing. Importantly, we see, like in these 3 subjects, that their resident, the place where they put their residence, and you know, the map behind these is obscured to protect confidentiality. But you know, they identified an area where they spend time and hang out, and their house is not even inside that. So, and really importantly, to the point of administrative data, when they overlaid these in GIS with census tracts and intersected them, they found that on average, these perceived neighborhood areas intersected over 10 census tracts. And so, you know, we can, I think that we all know the fine scale at which health disparities and disparate exposures can operate in urban areas due to zoning, residential segregation, all of these things. And so that finding of 10 census tracts, it would be a really a long shot for any one of those census tracts to accurately represent the lived space of any of these young people. So the second study is from Dr. Claudia Colton, who, like Bob said, will be here in a couple weeks. And this was from the Making Connections initiative of the Annie Casey Foundation, in which they're interested in improving outcomes for young people by improving family and community services. And so they're in this study, a very large study, where they targeted disadvantaged neighborhoods in 10 cities. And then they had a more in-depth household survey where they had, again, a hand-drawn mapping exercise. And here their objective was, after having it in GIS, overlaying the residents' perceived neighborhood areas with each other, and then breaking them down to a smaller scale so that they could find, or decomposing those neighborhood areas to finer blocks or lattice, so that they could identify consensus or what they call endorsed neighborhoods. And so this is an example of their Providence site. And so, you know, here you can see these all these different neighborhoods, and through a kind of a cluster analysis, they were able to identify two what they call endorsed neighborhoods. So, I mean, this is really cool that despite the wide variation in size and shapes of neighborhoods, they were able to locate areas in these cities that they could target for, in this case, employment services, and really continue to invest in services that would support collective action for community change initiatives. So reading these studies really made our minds explode, you know, from a measurement perspective. And yeah.
In getting residents to endorse the neighborhoods, are they looking at a map and drawing boundaries, or are
that's a good question. So this is the term from the paper that they use, endorsed. It's not the residents provide their individual perspective on this is my neighborhood, and endorsed in this sense is more of a quantitative term. So it's the area that had the most common overlap among the most people.
Yeah.
And I think that Dr. Cole will probably talk about that.
Yeah, Jesse, my address, unlike your, I'm not familiar with your previous study, which sounded much more open-ended, this one, respondents were given a paper map of a slightly bigger area of what might be called their neighborhood, and then they drew. So the digitized maps are from what, so they weren't given their city and then drew from that. They were given already what was
so
a fairly
defined
piece. So they
start with these targeted neighborhoods because they're really trying to understand, you know, if you can think about from a public health practice or, an intervention perspective, you know, understanding there's a lot of support for place-based interventions. But you really have to, I mean, their motivation is trying to really understand what those places mean. And it's no good if we put an intervention in a place that, you know, only, that is not recognized as a place of meeting or, you know, common place. So anyway, these two, did that address your question?
The reason I ask is there's a potential for a lack of familiarity with a map or a print-based medium of trying to identify where you live, where they might know it by landmarks or be able to describe to you, but couldn't find themselves on a map.
And this is a question that we really get into. There are definitely, in this case, this was a household survey, and they had a very specific definition of neighborhood and a person who had, you know, prompts to talk somebody through that type of thing. But that issue of cartographic or map literacy is something that we address definitely here. And so it's a perfect transition to have Isaac talk a little bit about, you know, this motivation for moving from hand-drawn maps to a different kind of online platform.
As we show, there are some challenges with hand-drawn maps in terms of the sample size you're able to access, the difficulty of digitizing the data into a format that you can use to analyze. And so the advantages of moving to an online tool are readily apparent. And there's also two major reasons that we felt comfortable making the jump into online as opposed to the hand-drawn maps that were used a few years ago. And the first is data interoperability. It's we used a Google Maps interface, and it is much easier nowadays to make comparisons and to take that data that you pull out of Google Maps, which is in a KML format, and pull it into existing software analysis programs like ArcGIS or any other of those data software programs. And the other one is this general, when we were talking about the general map literacy, and people are becoming a lot more comfortable not only with standard maps, but with online maps. And so with Google Maps interfaces, they use them on their phones, they see them a lot more places. It's much more common. The average person is going to be much more familiar, and so you don't have to quite start at square one. You already have a background that allows you to ask them questions and allows you to, with a level of confidence, ask them to draw a map. And so we'll start by walking through the major objectives of our tool. The first was to create an actual user-friendly tool, something that we felt comfortable presenting to these people. The second was to validate that tool. Because this is a relatively new thing, we wanted to make sure that the data that we were getting out of this tool was something that we felt comfortable reporting, and that we felt comfortable that the users were actually outputting information that represented what they felt. And the third was, once we have this data, how do you quantify the differences between the user neighborhoods and the administrative boundaries, which is what we're really trying to get at. So what conclusions can we draw from that? One of the first things we asked the participants in our study to do is to give the two cross streets, or the intersection closest to their home address. And when they continue on to the next page, we use that information to center our Google Map interface. And so that red pinpoint there, you can see, would have been the cross streets that each user gave. And so what they're presented with is this map, and they have directions on the side of the map that tell them step by step how to go about actually drawing what they consider to be their neighborhood. And if at this point they still felt uncomfortable with what we were asking them to do, we also provided, you can see, click here, there's a video that they could pull up, and it gave them a step-by-step process with images on how we wanted them to go about drawing this neighborhood. And so what we imagined you would get is you would essentially input the corners of your neighborhood as you perceived it, and it would include that cross street intersection that was your home. And what you end up with is this polygon here. And so that is the data that we're pulling from the users. And then after they've drawn that, we ask them a few questions, and these questions are starting to get at how do we validate that polygon? How do we make sure that's really what they were trying to provide us in terms of what they believe their neighborhood is? So one of the first things we ask is, how do you decide to draw the lines that is your neighborhood? Because one of the questions here is, how do people, when people think of neighborhood, what do they think of? How are they going about defining what they consider to be the area that they live? And then the second question we asked, which this became a huge question, is to list the streets and avenues that they were using in the tool, essentially the landmark that they were using to demarcate where their neighborhood is. And we were going to use this data later on to help them validate. And we also, to get an idea of how effective the tool is, how well we designed it, we asked them a few questions about their familiarity, whether they found it easy to make the drawings, and how accurate they actually thought they did. And anyway, so to get back to the question about the street, yes.
Can I ask a quick question? Mm-hmm. So, you know, this brought up the point about knowing sort of visual landmarks. Was there any way to use something like Street View, or was that not technically?
So all of the tools that we leveraged were the native Google tools.
Right.
So if somebody was we had it, the default was to come up on the map view.
Right.
Because we were concerned about kind of in different areas there might be, you know, some, like in Manhattan, for example, there's a lot of, you know, it would
right.
come up with tons of, you know, landmarks.
Yeah.
But in other neighborhoods, you know, it might be kind of differential density of that. So we thought that using the map view would allow for a more consistent, you
mm-hmm.
know.
But technically they could do it?
If they're
yep.
familiar with Google, they could have
right.
switched to
right.
the street view,
okay.
yeah. the earth view.
And it's important, you see, they have access to things like the zoom bar, so
right.
the scale that we presented them was too large or too small, they can zoom out and zoom in, do things like that.
Right, so that would just be the satellite on
right.
the top
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Once we had these neighborhoods and we had their description of what they thought they were drawing, we went through and we took these landmarks, and Jesse and I attempted to essentially redraw their neighborhood. Without looking at what they'd given us, we used, you know, if they said, I use this street and this park and this river, we attempted to use that to recreate their neighborhood to get an idea of how close what they were drawing came to the description of what they were drawing, which is one way to validate. And so while tedious, we went through and we step by step, and we had a protocol. We decided, you know, if they give us a park, we'll include it or not include it, things like that. We made decisions beforehand how we were going to interpret the information they gave us. And we step by step went through and recreated all these neighborhoods. And so we, based on this, we now had the user's information. So we had a point that said, this is the nearest intersection of our home, which we would use for comparing against administrative boundaries. We had what they defined to be their neighborhood, and we had what we thought they meant to define to be their neighborhood. And so with that data, and you can see this green box was what we had done. The red boxes are what they did in terms of inputting data. And traditionally, with a paper map, you would expect all the analysis to be composed much more of red boxes too, but we were able to automate a lot of that process. And so what one of the first things we did was take the narrative boundaries, and we took the, which is, when I say narrative boundaries, I'm referring to the boundaries that Jesse and I drew, and we took the user-defined boundaries, and we compared the two. And so we had a script that went through, and this is a model builder version, and even over the course of the study, we were able to go from a relatively complex model builder tool to a much simpler Python script, which was very nice, because things change very fast in these fields right now. And so we were able to go through, and very easily we were able to automate the process of comparing each individual's data output to what we consider to be the data output and what administratively it was defined that it should match up with. And so we were able to cut a lot of time and essentially make it much more efficient to actually analyze the data, as opposed to a couple years ago where those past researchers had to go through and step-by-step digitize and do all that. So we were able to vastly simplify. And just to give you kind of an example of some of the things we were looking at, here we have 3 points, and you can see they're relatively close in location. So you might expect that administratively they would be defined to live in the same area, and so the same information would be applied to all three of these people. But you can also imagine where it'd be quite easy for these people to define completely different neighborhoods depending on how close they were to a park. Maybe they include that in their neighborhood. Essentially, just because they live maybe close to each other doesn't mean that they're going to end up having the same idea of where they actually live. And you can see later in that survey that I was showing you, we didn't show you all the questions, but there are a lot of questions about demographic information, so their age, their sex, income level, things like that. And so that information we can then pull in and connect to the user's neighborhood. Sorry.
Did you find specific features that acted as, say, barriers to neighborhoods? So even though visually someone could say they look like they live in the same place, you find out, for instance, in the last one, one on one side of a park, one on the other, and their neighborhood, you know, their identification is very different.
That's definitely one of the things we're looking at, in terms of trying to understand how people define their neighborhoods, is those kind of, you know, major roads. Do people tend not to cross those major roads? Things like that. I mean, no, to a certain degree, well, there was, I shouldn't speak, so we haven't fully quantified, you know, things like that, but it's, there's a lot of different elements. Now that we can pull in large amounts of data on what people define their neighborhoods, questions like that are now beginning to become possible to answer, which is, I guess, the more interesting thing. And so hopefully at some point we'll be able to understand in a much better fashion, you know, how do people, what things do people not cross, and what things do people generally include in their neighborhood.
Well, so yeah, because getting into that stage of the analysis next. At this stage, what we're showing is the validation of the tool itself.
Yeah, because in New York, you have community-defined planning districts. Planning is community-defined in New York, and they're fairly big from our perspective, but for New York, they're pretty small, and there's a lot of people in it. They'll be really interested in a lot of this, because it'll give a certain amount of quantification to things that they know as community planners, and they're trying to get resources to do things about, so they'll be very, very interested.
It's very exciting, the kind of things you can start to pull when you have access and the ability to analyze such large amounts of data on individual neighborhoods and how people perceive them. Mm-hmm.
going back to your previous slide, it's sort of this one that gives an example of demographic information. Mm-hmm. Just in some of this work we've done off the cuff and talking to generations of people, depending on the age of the person you're talking to, you can get a completely total analysis of the neighborhood by landmarks, by streets, by anything. In other words, I can go on the hill and I can talk to a person about the old Pasadena Hospital and where and what it was, and another generation will come and say, well, yeah, that's Reed Roberts' apartments, and somebody else now will come and say, that's just an empty lot. You understand me? So how are you translating the different age segments of people and then pulling it all together? I see how you got the three, where the three places come together and pretty close. So are you using that to sort of bring together?
One of the interesting parts about the fact that we're asking them, one, how they define their neighborhood, and two, the landmarks they're using, is that we were able, and there's also a comment section where they're able to expound a little bit more about what they thought about the study and what they might have been thinking, why they were conducting the survey. And we did get a lot of information about, you know, the landmarks they were using, and we were able to essentially, you know, if it was somebody older who was using a landmark that didn't necessarily exist in Google Maps, but they used it anyway, they often mentioned that, and we were able to, you know, if we didn't know, we were able to search and find out about it and use that in our recreations. But there definitely was a lot of variability in terms of the landmarks that people were using, which was very interesting to see.
This is actually an interesting point that we haven't really thought much at all about yet, because we expected some difference possibly to explore down the road in how people of different ages define their neighborhood now.
Right.
But we haven't yet thought about, and it's an intriguing idea, we could ask people of different age cohorts, how would you have defined it 10 years ago? Or how would you have defined it when you were a child in this community? So this tool could be used to ask that question, potentially. But you'd be stuck with, you know, potentially the map of today as a reference.
Well, you could, if you're doing it in Pittsburgh, you could use the historic Pittsburgh map viewer.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be cool.
One that goes the whole way through.
I learned a lot about the South Hills.
I think it's really exciting that we're, like, already moving into applications about this, but I just want to.
We still
had a lot of doubts about whether this was actually a viable tool and whether we weren't inducing more bias, you know, by moving from something that was a hand-drawn map. And so, would it be okay to move forward with like we did this pilot study to talk about it. So then maybe we can. It speaks to some of your questions about, you know, whether there were different demographic things that predicted how people defined it. So, thank you. Very nicely done.
Can I ask you a quick question
just
before you go on?
Yeah.
When you went into this study, did you, is the assumption that there are neighborhoods that are defined by boundaries or by something, or is it the assumption that every individual has their own neighborhood? Does that make sense? Like, versus these geographic boundaries, how we see them on the neighborhood map.
Okay. To allow for inter-individual variability and to see where the bright lines are.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So this was a pilot study, again, that we did in collaboration with UXR and with Proud Plan. And we started out with just a small sample of people to kind of, like Isaac talked about, test the instructions and troubleshoot the interface. And so then the main study that I'll be talking about, we did in the spring and summer of last year. And the primary aims were, again, to validate this tool using the comparison between the narrative boundaries and the user-drawn boundaries, and then to develop these analytic models and test how well that we could use them to quantify metrics of that concordance. So we leveraged existing community organizations, which Bob's networks, which Bob spoke about and was really helpful with, and university networks in New York City and Pittsburgh. And we asked across a few domains of questions that Isaac already showed you. And concurrently, we were also running focus groups in New York City as part of the EPA STAR study that Jane talked about as a way that, and we had a neighborhood mapping exercise as part of that, so that a way that we could have some discussion and ask some questions to kind of bounce the interpretation off of what we were getting from this raw data. So the sample population that we got across these two cities were generally not representative, not surprisingly, of these two cities. So we were largely Caucasian, highly educated, and in both cities the income was above the median income for the whole city. So it was not, they were not representative samples, but the samples between the two cities were relatively comparable to each other. And so that was, encouraging moving forward, that at least we could begin to look at that issue of how, you know, that the results that we were seeing were not driven by the specific characteristics maybe of that city, and that we could compare those two populations to each other. So thank you, Jane. So this is Pittsburgh. So these are the people. So these are their, you know, blobs around their residential area that was driven by those cross streets in the survey that Isaac showed you. And so as you can see, we have a, you know, relatively strong spatial spread, but we are definitely clustered in certain parts of the city. So again, while we're not getting a representative spatial, you know, picture of how people all across Pittsburgh represented their neighborhood, it does give us the opportunity to look within neighborhoods and within these clusters of all these different people, you know, how do they differentially perceive their neighborhood, potentially. And so then on the other side are, these are the areas that they mapped, that they're user-drawn areas.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
How frequently did you find that people were drawing their neighborhoods, if not directly on the dot, then extremely adjacent to, because I see one in the CBD that there's no neighborhood, perceived neighborhood associated with the dot on the sample population map.
Right. I would say in New York there was four participants who put their residence was outside of their neighborhood area. And then in Pittsburgh, I think there was a handful as well. So it did happen. And that was, you know, similar as we saw in the BASTA study. So, that was to be expected. And in the focus groups, you know, we heard from young people, to speak to the generational issues, we heard from young people saying that, you know, my neighborhood where I hang out is around where I go to school. And so where I live is just some place I go to sleep. Is there another question?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you have a common definition of neighborhood for these people?
Good question. So we didn't. We specifically left it open-ended. And, because we were interested in asking people how they define neighborhood. And then there was another series of questions where we asked them about activities that they did, day-to-day activities that they conducted within their neighborhood and outside their neighborhood. So, you know, whether people had to leave their neighborhood to go grocery shopping or to go to the doctor or those kind of questions. So we struggled with this a lot. We had a lot of conversations about the relative advantages and disadvantages of giving a specific definition. Like, for example, in the two previous studies that we talked about, they defined it as where you spend your time. And we, in contrast, by asking people here how they defined it, we got some different, you know, some people did say it's where I spend the most of my time. A lot of people said it's the areas where I can walk to. Some people said it's where I, you know, it's where my family and I live. So there was a broad range of definitions. And so, especially for this, as this was a pilot study, I think we just chose to put more work on our end and leave it as open-ended as possible with the, you know, note. So. Yes,
you. You also do give, though, like the two cross streets to start up the map and where it's located. So I guess even though if you don't define neighborhood, that still kind of gives an indication of where to start.
A starting
potentially,
point.
Potentially.
Right. Right. And so we were, we worked with the people at PravPlan to think about not, you know, starting with a standardized area. So I think we had like it was a 3 mile square area in the map. So that we didn't, again, introduce bias based on, in Queens, things are more dispersed, so I might have gotten a map, you know, by default through Google that showed me more area than I would have in Manhattan. So we did pay attention to that, and so we were, you know, working kind of off of the walkability literature where they're defining neighborhood as like a, you know, kilometer square or kilometer radius. So we were, you know, we were kind of like working off of, you know, some previous spatial and conceptual definitions of neighborhood, But here we just decided that we wanted to leave it as open as possible.
Did anybody get it really, really close, like almost exactly?
Yes.
Yeah. And this speaks to kind of what you were talking about I'll just do it in New York because maybe that's where I'm more familiar. But I think that you were talking about kind of these really, really strong landmarks. So right here is 96th Street in Harlem. And this is the East Side, so this is East Harlem up here, and this is the Upper East Side, which is one of the most affluent neighborhoods in the country, and one of the most impoverished, at least in New York City. And so we were, you know, these kind of very, very strong boundaries, you know, that people do not cross. We expected to see them, and we did. And so, and not surprisingly, the administrative areas that we work with also subscribe to those. Boundaries.
Another good example here is Prospect Park in the middle of Brooklyn, which is a large park and a very large boundary. So most people very much define their neighborhood either to the east or the west of it. So you can see that there's quite a number of neighborhood self-definitions in that area, but the park we can see almost its entirety.
Yeah, great example. Mm-hmm. So here we are in New York City, and these are some neighborhood areas. And as same as Pittsburgh, our spatial spread was, you know, we were clustered in certain areas of the city, but again, that provided us... you know, you can just see up here on the Upper West Side, you know, what a range of... And, you know, here is a really good example of why this tool, you know, the kind of reason that, you know, you can only automate a process so much. You still need data analysts that can exclude implausible values, you know? So, you know, that's very well illustrated. So we did. And so we did exclude implausible, you know, implausible observations. Some of the results that we got from participants in the comment field, people were really enthusiastic about this. Well, some people, you know, thought that it was too long and boring, but other people really liked it. And so that's, as a biased subjective researcher, that's what I will present. And this first quote was really illustrative to the kinds of things that we get into, speaking directly to your question, about defining neighborhood. You know, and so this, I identify with them, so I assume it's a woman, but this participant, you know, talked about feeling like there are these kind of areas in my neighborhood where I don't go. So if I was to draw what it really was, it would be these like non-contiguous spaces. And so, you know, that opens up this, you know, all of these questions. And I guess that's, you know, if you're asking good questions, if it generates more questions. So these are some of the responses that we got. So going into the validation aspect of the study, referring to those questions of the ease and accuracy of using the mapping instrument, in both cities, you know, on a three-level scale of very to somewhat to not at all, we were generally pleased to see that people thought that it was easy and at least somewhat accurate depiction of their neighborhood. So in terms of successful completion, we were interested in this issue of, you know, just being able to, on the one hand, say, okay, these are the names of the streets or parks or whatever that I think, you know, bound my living space. And on the other hand, the ability to, you know, successfully point and click and make this polygon. So we were, one of the surprising to me results of this was that we found that overall in both cities, people were much more able to draw a polygon, even if it was that crazy, you know, point that went into the, you know, the river in the Bronx. But relatively fewer people were able to actually fully describe a neighborhood or, you know, give enough boundaries that Isaac and I, within the protocols that we defined, could draw the neighborhood. Yeah.
One of the things, you know, your crazy outlier triangle up there, and some of the work that I've done. That point out there in the river actually is a part of their perceived neighborhood. That
right.
view of the river
yes,
well,
right.
is a very important.
Right.
That's really important. And so
that's a great point.
Don't discount it too quickly.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. That's a good point. It is all about perception. So thinking about, just getting back to this basic question about the actual size of the neighborhood that people are demarcating, when we compare the narrative versus the user-defined areas, In Pittsburgh, there was no the difference between these areas was not statistically significant, which is awesome. And then, but in New York, in general, there was a difference, and in general, people were drawing larger areas than, or they were saying larger areas than they actually drew. So they might say, well, my neighborhood is from, you know, 113th to 76th, but then they actually drew something.
But did they walk more in New York, though? Is that part of it, perhaps? That, you know,
that they walk more?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. We kind of, we like, this goes back to the kind of question about, you know, in a GIS, we have the ability to link these neighborhoods now with subway lines, with bus lines, with all of these types of things, and, you know, do some more, you know, ask some more analytic questions. We're not there yet, but...
If I could pick up on that point, that might explain the difference between New York and Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
and I think we
That's
do bear
think,
that
yeah.
out,
mm-hmm.
because we see smaller areas being suggested
yeah.
in New York than in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
That may well be part of it. But I think what Jesse's pointing to is this interesting difference between what people describe in their words
mm-hmm.
versus what they would actually draw.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of intriguing that in New York it was so much smaller when they actually drew it.
Mm-hmm.
In Pittsburgh it almost mm-hmm. slightly goes the other way.
Maybe they think they walk more.
Maybe that's it.
Well, we were surprised in Pittsburgh because it is a more car-centered place.
Yeah.
We expected people to have kind of a better understanding of the roads and the street names. Like, for example, in our protocols, somebody could have given a boundary. In New York, they could have said, you know, my neighborhood is from the A train to the D train,
uh-huh.
and that would have been fine. But we were a little bit surprised by this. Pittsburghers apparently are not.
Jesse, don't you, I mean, in Pittsburgh, we've got street signs which say Squirrel Hill.
Yeah,
City,
I was wondering that, too.
In
yeah.
New York, how you define Chelsea depends upon whether
yeah.
you
want
to say it's an OE place to live and so I live there.
Right.
So it's a much fuzzier kind of thing in terms of how you define a neighborhood.
Which is exactly why we were really excited about working in these two cities. I remember one of the first meetings that we had when Jane had come to Pitt, we met with Ravi Sharma, and he was talking to us about how this is a place where neighborhood boundaries actually have meaning.
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes?
Is that enough?
Yeah, I can do that.
And then we can get into questions.
Cool. I think that, yeah, I can wrap up the results really quickly. But we were so excited by that, you know, because coming from New York, these things are, like, very contentious. And so that's part of it. So are you saying that people are primed to know, they're told all the time.
Know that this
yeah.
is Squirrel Hill because
yeah.
I can see the signs as
yeah.
well.
Even if it's subliminal, they see that. Yeah.
Well, I'll get to that.
And look, and it's very different out in the Midwest where you have meets and bounds definitions
yeah.
and you don't have things in that flat featureless plane to identify.
All right, well, I just want to speed through some to get to some of these issues. So in terms of concordance between these narrative and user-drawn areas, we define that as the area of overlap that fell within the user-drawn polygon. So we're going to percents here to account for different areas between the cities. So we were really pleased to see that between these two things, we had 81 and 73% concordance among our plausible observations. So moving on to the ways that we tried to validate it, we were looking across these kind of socio-demographic domains to see if, despite this kind of like overall good performance of the tool, whether we could find differences based on these classics. So when we looked at, again, this issue of completing the task of giving your street names, we only found two significant kind of predictors of a difference between being able to and not. In New York City, age. So on average, those who were not able to tell to report the narrative boundaries of their neighborhood were on average younger than those who were. And in Pittsburgh, this is only marginally significant, 0.08, but those who were not able to report a full narrative boundary were on average in a lower income strata. So these are by, you know, multiples of the poverty line. So when we looked at this agreement, that concordance that I described between the common area as a percent of the user-drawn area, we found no differential agreement across any of those socio-demographic characteristics, which was, you know, if that metric of as a validation is a valid one, we need to validate our metrics now. So we were very pleased with that. So when we looked at going back to this question of administrative areas, We looked across census tracts and neighborhood districts in Pittsburgh and across a wider list in New York City, and again, quantified agreement between these things as the common area as a percent of the user-drawn neighborhood area. There are other metrics that you could calculate.
You're using the city neighborhoods from the census tracts, is that right?
In Pittsburgh, we use census tracts, and we also use the city planning neighborhood boundaries.
Which are based on
census
tracts.
Like
they're slightly different, but so those are the
there's
ones.
There's changes, but the number of neighborhoods has increased in each time that we have a decennial census.
Right.
So that's
we're using 2010.
Yeah,
these
so 2010. These are
2010. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and likewise in New York, these are 2010 census tracts. We had a shrinkage. So just to get a picture, so in New York City, this is Lower Manhattan, the Bronx, and Brooklyn, sorry. So these are census tracts. You can see the relatively fine scale of them overlaid with the areas that people drew. So again, you can see some of these hard barriers. This is 14th Street. And then in Pittsburgh, these are also census tracts, and you can kind of begin to see some of the... It's a kind of a crazy map, but such a pleasure to make maps in Pittsburgh because of the rivers. So when we looked at the percent agreement between these different administrative areas and the user-drawn polygons, oh, this was trivia for Pittsburgh GIS people. but so this was really surprising. So in New York City, these fairly gross levels of aggregation are often criticized as, not meaningful and obscuring, the real important within variability, which I'm confident they actually do. So, however, in terms of the perceived neighborhoods in our small pilot population, these had a much better overall agreement than did the more commonly used census tracts as an indicator of neighborhood. In Pittsburgh, both of these, 40 and 50% agreement, not a big difference. And again, these minimums, these zeros, those are, to speak to your question, those are those individuals whose residence didn't fall even within, their neighborhood. So, again, there's other, metrics that we could, that we plan to calculate in the future and look for differential kind of coverage across space. We didn't use space as one of the characteristics or the categories that we were trying to look across differences. We plan to do that in the future. So I don't have time to, I think we've talked about a lot of the strengths and weaknesses of this pilot study. But one of the main strengths I think that we have to talk about is the local knowledge of the technicians and coming from a multidisciplinary team was really indispensable. So the conclusions, we were really surprised to see that thing that perhaps people are at this point in time better able to visualize than say, what the space they inhabit is. And perhaps it is possible to identify an optimal, proxy for neighborhood, which are both very promising things for health disparities research moving forward. And broadly, that a tool like this can provide information that can help us to refine our multi-level hypotheses of neighborhood-level effects and try to, further dig into what are the mechanisms that are actually driving, all of this interest in neighborhood effects research. Moving forward, Jane covered most of this stuff already, so this survey is currently in the field in its second wave in New York City and in Pittsburgh, and we are going to be using that output to... very excited to start to try to develop a smooth, continuous surface of stress, perceived stress. And then again, to use these to improve our measurement, our exposure assessment of both air pollution and stress in childhood asthma epidemiology. And that's all. Thank you so much.
Thanks. We could open it up to a few minutes of questions.
Yes. I'm sorry, she had her hand up before.
I think this is very hopeful as well as a very
promising technology because in Pittsburgh, particularly, a lot of research was done in the 70s on the question of how neighborhoods define themselves or should be defined, and it, and the Neighborhood Atlas, which was done by the research at Pitt, was one of the kind of prominent products of that, where they researched out in the neighborhoods and actually did some of the same kinds of questioning, but you've now advanced the tools so much that it makes it much more possible to do this. I think one of the implications is not only that it makes research, you know, it opens up better ways of interpreting information, but there's a serious issue in terms of policy in the city, and the city's Department of Planning has regressed from the 70s when they initially recognized community-defined boundaries of neighborhoods, and they went back, I think partly because they were cut back so seriously in their staff, they went to a fallback of census tracts. And I don't think anybody can seriously argue that census tracts define neighborhoods, nor are they based on anything that has relevance to the meaning of a neighborhood to people. And I think that this should be one of the ways in which we begin to really challenge cities like Pittsburgh, I'm sure they're not the only one, to get rid of this pseudo-definition of neighborhoods. And it is a source of serious issues in the community. And I know that just working in communities, the claims over territory, which are inevitable among communities as things change, need to be addressed. And they keep getting completely dismissed by the planning department because they say, we've got our neighborhood defined and it's defined by a census tract. I think we all know that that just is untenable.
And in terms of the, you know, disparities in access to and quality of resources, all those decisions at a policy level are made based on these administrative areas. And so they really, you know, can have a role in kind of enforcing, you know, cycles of disadvantage. Excellent. Lawyer?
Thanks for a wonderful presentation. My question is, so in your next phase of research, what are you doing to do differently to make sure that you have a more ethnically diverse sample population?
Right.
So in the first one, you had, I think it was like
80%
white in both Pittsburgh and in New York. So I'm wondering, what are you going to do differently to make sure?
Well, we have more money. Yes. So that's, again, so this was like kind of semi-convenient sample. And so now working with the survey research group here at UXER, so the survey that we've designed as part of the EPA STAR study is spatially stratified. So we have, our focus there is more covering, like saturating across space, and then hoping that through that, we don't have a recruitment criteria on race or ethnicity. So in, for example, in our first wave of the online and random digidial survey, we had much better representation across across racial composition, and we were still a little bit heavy on, we had more participants that were white than in the, you know, in New York City, and just like we had more participants who were older, and just like we had you know, so part of that is, aside from putting in an explicit criteria for balancing across, you know, population characteristics, I think that we're hoping that the spatial allocation, you know, based on what we know about, like, the segregation of neighborhoods, I think that we're hoping that that will balance some of the ethnic composition of the sample.
And one of the other pieces we can add on that point is our partners on this EPA STAR grant, our REACT for Environmental Justice in East Harlem. West Harlem, I'm sorry. And they actually helped us in some of the very earliest phases of development of this tool on some of the development of the questions that went into it and some of our early focus groups. They tried out the hand-drawn version before we actually went into the online system, and they'll be helping us to ensure that we're getting a good
distribution across New York as we go forward. And yes, it is true that we're hoping that spatial variation also means demographic variation.
So for example, like we had some vocabulary in there, I think, around the word barrier. Or I forget
borders.
Border.
What lines border?
Yeah, well, so we had this word in there that I did not associate that, but had a different, totally different meaning for an immigrant, Latin American immigrant community in New York City. And they were just like, this, you know, this word is not, you know, has a totally different meaning than what you, so that's a, you know, that's a limitation of our study. And that we're hoping to, you know, investigate. And
as far as comfort with an online tool like this, it'll be interesting because I know American Community Survey has started to go online and Census has been talking about pushing to an online. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of, in terms of, you know, spatially, do they get a general, you know, 80% of people respond this way, or do they see variability depending on, you know, income and demographic factors on how many people actually respond with an online tool like that.
Well, just your comment about city planning, Don Musa was with us, was one of the people at UXER working on neighborhood boundaries and the computer programming sets back in the 70s, and we've got some of that work still around. And census tracts are based on population. I mean, that's what they are. That's what the Census Bureau does. It counts people, and it creates a spatial boundary by population. What happened in the city to make its definition of, quote, neighborhoods, and the change, some of that was the basis of, which now, as you're talking about variability in census, is going to change, and the ability to create neighborhoods and from data that you couldn't do before, especially after the 1980 and 1990 census when you got a bunch of paper. I was presenting at a conference in the spring, and my former colleague Bob Beauregard, who's in the planning department at Columbia now, lived in Pittsburgh and the 1990s, raised his hand and said, Sabina, all those years, I thought I lived in Squirrel Hill. I didn't realize I lived in Squirrel Hill South. So I think you got really, you got really interesting results. On the New York side, what also would be interesting is neighborhoods and walkability. So people are talking about, they're verbally giving you a larger neighborhood, and when they draw it, they give you a more constrained neighborhood. Where they go buy bread and milk and go out and do their daily chores is going to be different than what they call the Upper West Side or Brownsville or, you know, so forth. So you could add in your next survey kind of a subjective question on that and test if what they describe as their neighborhood is what they think of as the Upper East Side or the Upper West Side. What they draw is where their neighborhood where they live and work or, you know,
turn down the map score, walk score.
Yeah, the walk. I was gonna say you can add the walk score adds a whole different piece to that.
So I'm gonna get like one last question. We have time for one more question.
Yeah.
Okay. So my question is getting at that. So did you get a sense at all from the focus groups whether there's variability in the way people define their neighborhoods based on what you're asking about? Because I'm asking because I've done some work on perceptions of neighborhood safety, and I noticed that in neighborhoods where people will describe drug activity and hearing gunshots and all this stuff, people will say, when you ask, is your neighborhood safe, they will say yes, but there's stuff that happens over on the next block or over at the end of the block or, you know, I mean, so there becomes these very, you know, they're describing that as their neighborhood, but I suspect that if you hadn't talked about safety in particular, they might have given a more wide description of the neighborhood. And so it just made me think about that when you're trying to measure chronic stress. That would be...
That's a very important point, and that came up quite a bit in the early development of this tool. And we went back and forth for a long time on which questions would come before or after the map. Because we didn't want to bias what came into their minds as a neighborhood definition. We wanted to allow them to ground themselves up front and then ask a few follow-up questions. And for the same reason, we chose to implement the map at the beginning of the focus groups rather than at the end. So that people would be grounded in the space that they self-identify as the neighborhood, and then the focus group went on to ask other questions about stressors in their neighborhood. What I'm envisioning that you propose very nicely is a future iteration, which is what's the area you define as your neighborhood? Where's the area where you actually go? because that might help us understand those spaces that people avoid, which has been a big question for us around parks, because in some neighborhoods, parks is a tremendous resource, and green space, maybe during the day, can also be perceived as an unsafe location to other individuals within the neighborhood, and that might be a way to use this tool to disentangle some of that.
Yeah.
That was fantastic. I just want to say thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Great question.